Thank you, Dr. Wang, and thank you to CF40 and the Shanghai Finance Institute for the invitation to speak at this summit. I think the theme of the summit, new finance, new technology, new trends, really captures the excitement of the payments industry at the moment. But it's also a challenge for regulators, because we want to encourage innovation, but at the same time, we want to ensure that payments are safe for users and that there's a level regulatory playing field. So today I'm going to talk about some of those challenges and how we're thinking about them at the Reserve Bank of Australia. I'll start briefly by setting out the Australian regulatory framework, just very briefly, and then I'm going to talk about a few key forces shaping payments, which you will have heard a little bit, you will have heard about in previous presentations. And then I'm going to talk about some of the potential implications for retail payments and for regulators. So first of all, the payments regulatory landscape in Australia. So like in China, the primary regulator of the payment system in Australia is the central bank, the Reserve Bank of Australia. And the Reserve Bank's payment system policy is determined by the Payment System Board. This is chaired by the Governor of the Reserve Bank, and it includes a number of external members as well. The key duties of the Payment System Board with respect to the payment system are to ensure the powers of the bank are exercised in a way that best contribute to controlling risk in the financial system, promoting efficiency of the payment system, and promoting competition in the market for payment services, which, provided it's consistent with overall stability of the financial system. Now, the Reserve Bank has very strong powers to regulate payment systems, and in some cases, in fact, it does. So, for example, there were certain competition and efficiency issues associated with credit card systems, and these couldn't be addressed by the participants. So the Reserve Bank actually introduced regulation that required changes to practices in some of these schemes. But the bank's preferred approach is to identify areas where competition and efficiency or safety could be enhanced, and then we encourage the industry to address those issues. And a very good example of this was the development of the new payments platform in Australia, what we call the NPP. So the NPP is an open access infrastructure for fast payments in Australia. It went live earlier this year, and it's gradually ramping up with more volumes. And the new system allows users of the payment system to send real-time payments with very simple addressing 24/7. It also allows more complete information to be sent with the payments. But this actually wasn't a spontaneous creation of the industry. It was developed in response to a number of strategic objectives for the Australian payment system, which were set by the Reserve Bank. And while the industry determined how it would meet the objectives, the Reserve Bank played a significant role in encouraging and facilitating the cooperation required to develop and build the system. So I'm going to move on now to speak about the forces shaping retail payment system, and there are three key forces. They're new payment channels, new technologies, and new participants. So increasingly, as we've heard at this summit, consumers are reducing their use of cash and they're using electronic payment methods. But they're also making electronic payments through new channels. Now, one example of these is using mobile devices to make payments. These devices have become ubiquitous, and they're now being used for payment at the point of sale, for online payments, and for in-app payments. Wearables and the Internet of Things more broadly are also expanding the devices through which payments can be made. In Australia, most of these new payment channels use the existing payment rails, in particular the card schemes. New technologies are also shaping retail payments. So we've heard a lot about distributed ledger technology and the blockchain over the last day or so, and they've been receiving obviously a lot of attention. There's suggestions that new payment mechanisms, this technology might be more efficient, for example, in cross-border payments, and it might even reduce the role for traditional financial institutions. But other technologies that are likely to facilitate innovation include cloud computing, artificial intelligence, and cryptography. These technologies have the potential to improve payment experiences for customers, as well as support new payment instruments. They're also allowing non-traditional players without a large physical footprint to compete with the established financial institutions. Which brings me to the third force shaping the retail payment system, new participants. So there's broadly three types of potential competitors. Most similar to the incumbent financial institutions are what we call digital banks or neobanks. These banks typically offer reasonably standard banking services, but through mobile apps. They're unencumbered by legacy systems and physical branch networks, and they can use newer technologies, and potentially this makes them more flexible and responsive to consumer needs. Then there are the fintech firms. Many of these are using technology to address particular frictions and gaps in the payment system. Online payments, point-of-sale technology and cross-border payments are all areas in which fintechs are innovating. And finally, there's the large global technology companies that can leverage their already extensive networks to offer proprietary closed-loop payment services. In China, there are two at the forefront of this, Alipay and WeChat Pay, but Google, Apple, Facebook and Amazon all have some payment functionalities within their networks, and they could potentially expand these. There's also moves around the world for banks to share the data of their customers with other participants, known as open banking. And this has the potential to promote competition and innovation further. So in Australia, we're in the process of implementing an open banking regime that will put customers in control of their banking data. It's expected that customers will be able to use these data to access better products and services. For example, consumers could ask their bank to share their credit card transaction history, their interest rate, fees, and other relevant data with a product comparison website. And using this information, and the website could then provide a tailored assessment of the best possible credit card for that individual. That would include an accurate estimate of potential savings compared with the current card. While there are a number of challenges in implementing this ambitious reform, such as ensuring data security and customer privacy, these can be addressed. And the Reserve Bank, we're very confident about the potential of open banking to deliver benefits for consumers. So with all this innovation and competition in the financial system, and the payment system in particular, a logical question is, what are the implications for policy and for regulation? So I'm going to address four here, but over the period of the last day or so, we've heard of many challenges. The four I'm going to talk about are the challenge in balancing innovation and regulation, the implications for efficiency of the payment system, security, and resilience of the payment system. So first on financial regulation. The important challenge for regulators is how to limit barriers to innovation while at the same time maintaining safe and efficient payment systems. This requires the regulators to be alert to any detrimental impact that regulations might have on innovative new products or innovative new participants. But new entrants might also find that it's difficult to get access to the underlying payments infrastructure. And some innovations might actually require participants who are competitors to cooperate with one another if they're going to get an innovative product off the ground. So the Reserve Bank, in our view, we need to play a proactive role in facilitating cooperative projects and monitoring potential access issues for new entrants. Most regulators around the world seem to be encouraging innovation while taking a proportionate approach to regulation. So what this often means is a graduated approach to regulation, depending on the activities of the new participants. For example, many jurisdictions have some type of regulatory sandbox in which the new participants can develop their services without the full weight of regulation on top of them. Some jurisdictions authorise payment service providers under less onerous conditions than it would apply to full financial institutions. In Australia, our prudential regulator, who's known as APRA, and our securities regulator, who's known as ASIC, they're also taking a graduated approach to new entrants. So the securities regulator has a sandbox framework. It's specifically designed to provide eligible fintech businesses with the flexibility to test their new products and services without the need for a licence. And similarly, the prudential regulator has established a framework for licensing restricted deposit takers, financial institutions. And this allows potential entrants to the banking sector to conduct some limited banking business for a period of time under a much simpler prudential framework, and then they can develop their capabilities and resources. I think what's important about these two frameworks, though, is that the new entrants are expected to eventually meet the same requirements as other financial service providers, because if they weren't, then you would end up with a regulatory playing field. But the point is you give them a bit of time to improve their capabilities, bring their products up to scratch, and get themselves in business. I think there's two issues that are particular to Australia and the Australian payment system that are potentially going to be of interest to the financial regulators in Australia. The first is access. I already mentioned this, but new payment service providers will need access to underlying payments infrastructure to compete with the incumbent financial institutions. Non-bank providers of payment services already have access to accounts at the Reserve Bank for the purposes of settlement, so that's already on a level playing field. But they're also going to need access, either direct or indirect, to payment clearing systems. And while they might be able to commercially negotiate an agency arrangement, this could add to their costs, and they might therefore prefer direct access to the clearing system. If incumbent financial institutions, those that are already there, control the access, they might seek to put up unreasonable barriers to entry. And regulators are going to need to be alert to potential anti-competitive conduct by incumbent financial institutions. The second area is what I'd call stored value products. So traditionally, payment services have been provided by regulated financial institutions through transaction accounts. And these institutions are prudentially supervised to ensure that the public can have confidence that they'll be able to meet their financial commitments under all reasonable circumstances. And in addition, in most countries, including Australia, retail deposits would be protected if the bank were to fail. We have depositor insurance. But some of the new entrants are holding client funds on their books as stored value, and this raises a number of policy questions. Should, for example, these funds that these new providers are holding be treated like deposits? If not, do the firms who are holding the funds need to be regulated in some other way to protect consumers? And if the new entrants are very large, like the big technology companies, they could potentially hold substantial amounts of value in their closed systems. What are the implications for systemic risk of such a market structure? I don't have the answers to these questions, but these are some of the questions I think that regulators are working through and grappling with. Second issue I want to talk about is efficiency. So there's a great potential for new products to improve payment services, but this will depend on the extent to which there are gaps and frictions in the payment process. There's probably three areas in Australia, at least, that have received some attention here, and they're micropayments, programmable money, and cross-border payments. So the concept of micropayments of, say, 1/100th of a yuan or Australian dollar is not new. Indeed, micropayments idea has been around for decades. But in recent years, the demand for a micropayment service has typically been from internet content providers looking for alternatives to the advertising or monthly subscription business models. But when we look ahead, the development of an Internet of Things potentially greatly broadens the demand for the ability to make very small payments at low cost. The challenge in addressing this gap is how to recover costs, or indeed how to be profitable when the value of each transaction is so small. And I think this is an area where fintech are looking very closely. Second area is programmable money. That is payments that occur automatically if certain terms or conditions are met. So this could improve efficiency by minimising the need for human intervention. For example, online payments for goods could be held as a deposit with an independent third party and then automatic released once the goods are confirmed as delivered. There's other possible applications here, including payments that occur within complicated business supply chains. And cross-border payments, which we've in fact already heard about today and yesterday, they're widely regarded as an area in which significant potential efficiency gains exist. The current processes are slow and costly, they involve significant compliance burden, and a number of financial institutions are typically involved in a variety of different jurisdictions. So new technologies and business models could be used to address some of these frictions, and we've already heard from Ant Financial about the fact that the blockchain has been used to do just this. So while there's potential efficiency gains from addressing some of these gaps, there are still reasons for regulators to keep an eye on developments that might result in inefficient outcomes. Some of these arise from the existence of network effects. So a very large network that incorporates payments as just one part of its services, it might be able to lock in the payments business, because even if it's more costly to use those that particular payment service, customers might be unwilling to go somewhere else and leave the broader ecosystem of that network. The trend towards embedding payments in applications or other devices could also lead to inefficient outcomes. So while automated payments are likely to be convenient for consumers and merchants, they also might make it more difficult for alternative payment methods to compete, and they might reduce the sensitivity of users to changes in the prices of payment mechanisms. The third issue I want to touch on is security, and this again has featured in the summit. With increasing commercialisation of customer data, interest in people's personal banking data, including payments, is likely to grow. For example, it's been suggested that individuals could easily and securely share their personal banking information while retaining ownership of that data. There could be new services developed to facilitate personalised financial services. And more generally, the advent of big data analytics to generate insights into behaviours of individual consumers has increased interest in access to the data on consumer payments behaviour. But with more data being stored and shared, data security and cybersecurity generally will be more important ongoing issues for the industry and for regulators. The incumbent financial institutions, they already invest a lot in securing their customers' data and in managing fraud in payment systems. They mostly do this without the need for regulators to be involved because it's in their interests to ensure they maintain the trust of their customers. But with the new participants and new technologies, there is a risk that security vulnerabilities and opportunities for fraud will arise. And the strength of the system in this circumstance is only as good as its weakest link. So it's essential that all participants in payment systems and the financial system broadly manage and mitigate these risks. And I think regulators do have a role possibly to play in encouraging adoption of minimum standards in this area. The final area is resilience. Traditionally, central banks and regulators have paid a lot of attention to resilience of high-value payment systems because of the systemic disruption that would occur if these systems were, in fact, to suffer an outage. High-value payment systems are therefore subject to very high standards of operational resilience. Retail payment systems typically haven't been required to meet such high standards, but with electronic payments becoming increasingly important, the resilience of the electronic payment systems is becoming quite critical to the smooth functioning of economies. People are carrying less cash, so an outage in a retail payment system can mean that customers just can't undertake transactions. So in Australia, for example, a major bank had an outage recently and all of its merchant customers had to turn customers away. They couldn't take any electronic payments, people didn't have cash, so they had to turn their customers away. So these sorts of outages disrupt commerce and they erode the trust of consumers in the payment systems. So I think regulators around the world are now starting to focus on the operational risks associated with retail payment systems and whether the operators and the participants are meeting appropriately high standards of resilience. So in conclusion, there's a lot happening in retail payments and it's happening very, very quickly. Financial technology is facilitating the development of new payment products and the entry of new participants, and it's potentially transforming the customer experience. It has the potential to enhance competition and increase efficiency in the payment system. I think recognising this, regulators in Australia and in other countries are encouraging innovation, but nevertheless, the regulators do need to keep up with this fast-changing world and the implications for efficiency and safety of the payment system. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much. I thought what I'd do in my 5 minutes is expand a little bit on some of the themes that I talked about earlier in my speech. And that's really about the way regulators are approaching this attempt to balance innovation and security and safety for the economy. So if I look around the world at various regulators that I'm sort of in touch with, I think the general flavour, as it is in Australia and I think in China as well, is we're looking to encourage fintech and we're looking to encourage innovation, but we're all very conscious that there are important issues of safety and therefore that this isn't actually a regulation-free area. So innovation can spring up under appropriate regulation. It doesn't need to be regulation-free. And you've heard the term sandbox a number of times in this summit, and the idea of the sandbox is, I think in Singapore there was a couple of versions of it. One was a regulator sandbox, I think, and the other was an industry sandbox. I think the industry sandbox is a fairly common thing around the world, and that's where they're not regulation-free, but they're operating in a very sort of constrained environment. They're working with proofs of concept. The fintechs are working with proofs of concept in order to get their business models up and running in a regulation light way. As I said, it's not regulation free. I think it's regulation light. So that's a very common theme. And what this regulation is actually aiming at is customer protection, in effect. So many of the sandboxes are being set up by consumer protection agencies and by securities regulators. So the concerns here are about consumers, about they don't want consumers to be victims of fraud, they don't want consumers to find that their savings have all flown out the door. So it's all about consumer protection. The other angle, I think, on regulation of fintech at this stage is investor protection. And the topic of ICOs came up earlier. ICOs are, I think, an interesting example of innovation for small companies who want to get something off the ground and they want a bit of... It's in effect equity sort of finance in a way. It's not quite the same, obviously, but it's similar. So they're looking for capital injections and technology is providing them with a way of being able to get that. Again, this is where regulators come in because there are examples where they are just plain fraudulent. So regulators can't step back completely from this. They have to be active, they have to be watching, and they have to be monitoring to make sure that consumers and investors are protected. This is a sort of an interesting contrast in a sense because most of the regulation that we see on financial institutions is aimed at stability of financial institutions. It's aimed at prudential supervision. It's making sure that financial institutions don't fail and take people's money with them. That's not the concern of regulators at the moment with fintech. That's not to say that's not where it will go, because if some of these companies get big enough, there will be systemic issues. And that then raises the issue of what sort of standards do we impose on them. My colleague here spoke a little bit about the international jurisdiction here. Everyone does something a little bit differently. With financial institutions, the major world economies have gone to a great deal of effort to try and standardise regulation across economies. So I think it's going to be interesting to see whether or not regulation of fintech also ultimately moves in that direction, because it's increasing cross-border, and whether or not regulators start to realise that there needs to be some sort of cooperation in setting regulation. The other point I'd like to make briefly is that regulation really needs to be functionally based. So this came up in another session as well. If it looks like financial intermediation, even if it's not called a bank, then it probably needs to be regulated on a similar basis. So, and I think functional regulation is really important here, and in setting up legislation and in setting up laws, we need to avoid tying requirements to particular types of institution. We need to look at what functions they're performing, what risks they are taking, and what risks they are imposing on the economy, and regulate consistently across those, regardless of the institution that is doing it. Finally, I mentioned in my speech the issue of cooperation and competition. Competition is what drives cost reductions, it drives efficiencies, but in the area of payments in particular, cooperation is actually really important. Standards is one area where we need, in fact, to cooperate, but we also might need to cooperate in providing utility infrastructure that all can access. The Singapore example of an EKYC, an industry utility that is for everyone. It's not a competitive space is another good example of that. So I think they're sort of my 3 points, I guess. Focus of regulators at the moment on consumer protection and investor protection. It should be basically functionally based and principles based. And finally, we need to think about where we might need to cooperate. Thank you.
Very quickly, I'm conscious of time, but just respond, in fact. Our view is more similar to Singapore's, which is that the case is less for retail and more potentially for business or wholesale, but for some of the reasons you highlight, but thank you.
So I mentioned actually in my speech this morning that we are embarking upon an open data process. And I think we're fairly lucky we're a little bit behind the curve here, because often it's better not to be at the bleeding edge. It's better to be a fast follower and learning from other jurisdictions. The way we're approaching it is to establish a consumer data right, and the way that's being done, that consumer data right, is actually going to rest with the competition regulator rather than, because, as you mentioned, Connor, it's not just about financial data, it's about all sorts of data. So we're in the process of establishing data standards which will apply for the sharing of data, the privacy of data, the security. So I think in terms of the cart before the horse, which Europe seemed to embark upon, we're trying very hard to make sure that we've got the liability regime worked out before the data is sharing. It will start with a small group of financial institutions with a small number of products, if you like, work out that, and then move forward to other sorts of data sharing outside the financial, within the financial sector, outside the financial sector. But the liability framework is really important, because you've got to make sure that the incentives are right for people to share, and that the incentives are on those who are receiving the data, the incentives are on them to treat the data with just as much respect of those who've given it up. Because we all know that in this world of cyber and security and IT, that everything is only as safe as the weakest link. So it doesn't matter how good the bank's security and the way they treat their data is, if they give it to someone and someone else is a weak link, then that just wrecks the whole thing. So I'm not saying it's going to be an easy task, but I think we're very conscious of those particular issues, particularly the liabilities.